Keefe, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hooray!
I am a member of the world-famous Mamaroneck Group, located at Mamaroneck, New York. You've all heard of that. It is nice to be back here. I was here in 1945. That's a long time ago. You can tell by looking at me, I've been somewhere for a long time. It's also good to be here because I've met so many of my friends in AA here from other places and other parts of the United States. My pal Gene Duffy is here, Tom Smith is here, and of course, Herb is here. And all those nice Al-Anon ladies are here, too, and that's always a pleasure. I was a little surprised that there were so many of the Al-Anon ladies here. I thought they'd all be over on the North Shore attending a very important meeting of the Al-Anon movement, which is being held in the mother church of all Al-Anon, the Church of Our Lady of Perpetual Revenge. Just testing. Let me tell you about my drinking. I don't want you to miss any of this. So. I grew up in one of the neighborhoods in New York City. And my neighborhood was rough, and it was tough, and it was Irish. Now, you won't know about this here on the islands, but they drank in that neighborhood. If you looked at where I lived, you'd see a little drinking. My mother, the widow O'Keefe, was known to take a drink from time to time. And when the pressure got on, Kitty would go for the light wines and the spirits, and something would fly, usually one of the children. My brother Billy, on the other hand, was a very bad drinker. And in a neighborhood of drunks, my brother Billy stood out as a drunk. So when I showed up at the local joint and ordered up whatever it was they were serving 14-year-olds that afternoon, no one paid any attention to me. It was just another O'Keefe coming by, seeming to do so naturally what came to the rest of the family. I don't even recall what they gave me that day. I suspect it was a beer. That was a neighborhood drink. Look at how calm I am here. Well, whatever it was, I liked it. I liked everything about it. I liked the way it looked. And I liked the way it smelled. And I liked the way it tasted. And I liked what it did for my head. And I liked the noise and the smoke and the confusion. And I liked the fistfights and the Irish music. I like the bullshit. That's what I really like. I was going through the parochial school system, in a manner of speaking, and I got into all the difficulties and troubles that you might imagine a young man would get into trying to go through that system drunk. I was thrown out of high school a number of times. I held the neighborhood record for being thrown out of high school, a record previously set by my brother Billy. When I was finished with high school, or more properly put, when they were finished with me, because someone made a mistake somewhere in a small school, I got a scholarship to college and I left the neighborhood. And I went north, and my drinking changed. And I found later on that every time I changed my environment, my drinking changed. When I got up north into New England, they weren't drinking the way we drank. There were no bars in that state, just restaurants. And they sat around at tables, and they drank beer out of bottles, and they sang college songs, and they wore white shoes in the wintertime. And being a man of no particular moral fiber, I got a pair of white shoes. I learned the words to some of those rah-rah songs, and I got very collegiate. World War II was just about over, and things were very slow on a campus, and it was also safe. So one day I got a haircut and joined the Navy. And I ended up on a minesweeper in San Francisco. And I hate to be indelicate at such a large gathering, but I have to tell you that I had a lot of trouble with my kidneys when I drank. Now, don't get ahead of me, lady. This is not easy. And in the Navy, we slept three to a tier, and the new man slept on top. I don't want you to get ahead of me now. This is building up to a big thing here. I came back from my first liberty in San Francisco with all the beer in me that I could buy, and I went to sleep, and I had an attack. And I got to meet the fellow that slept below me that night. He figured he'd be wet sometime in his naval career. It just hadn't occurred to him it would happen while he was sleeping. Shortly thereafter, and after being removed from the San Francisco City Jail by my division officer, I was sent here. And I saw all of the places of historic importance and the cultural benefits of the Pearl City Tavern and all of the religious shrines on Hotel Street. And I only was arrested once in Honolulu, and that I was innocent, so I was released, and my ship went off further. The rest of my service career was uneventful. I returned home after my enlistment to the neighborhood. Everything was under control in the neighborhood. The widow was out in the weeds somewhere. My brother Billy was over the hill from the New York City Police Department, having invited an American citizen of the Puerto Rican ancestry off a five-story roof. The citizen lived to identify the Irish cop, and my brother rejoined the Marine Corps, went into a more peaceful line of work. The 5220 Club was available for heroes. I qualified for a few checks. I gravitated to the local joint. I took up the game of shuffleboard. And I was planning a life of petty crime with some of my boyhood companions when I had one of those clear thoughts that come from time to time. I recalled that I'd been to college. So I got on a bus and I went up there. And I arrived in the middle of a blizzard, and I walked into this place, and there they were, sitting around a table, drinking beer out of a bottle, singing those songs, wearing those shoes. So I got another pair of shoes. And now a grateful government was sending a check every month, and I was relatively solvent and therefore moderately drunk at all times. One day I was staggering around the campus in my usual condition, and I saw a list of names on a bulletin board of people who were qualified to graduate, and my name was on the list. And that was excellent news. I thought I had another year to go. So I came back home to the neighborhood, and the question was what to do. And my uncles, who ran the family, had voted unanimously that I be a New York City policeman, because that's what my father had been. That's what my brother had been. And that's what all my uncles and cousins were doing, except for the two morons that worked for the telephone company. But I told them I'd received another scholarship and I'd be unemployed for the next several years. I was going to go to law school. And that was received with mixed emotions. But that's what happened. I went away to law school. And I hate to... I didn't know anything about lawyers before I went to law school. There were no lawyers in my neighborhood. We had cops and we had priests. We really didn't need any lawyers. disloyal to the profession that's done so well for me. But I have to tell you that when I arrived at law school, I found I was in the company of the greatest collection of stiffs that had ever assembled under one roof. They were deadly. And everybody had on a suit, and they all had eyeglasses. So I got a pair of glasses I didn't have. I got into uniform, and I looked around for a companion, someone to drink with. My mother always told me, play with nice boys your own age. And I looked around. Nobody drank in this crowd. They were all studying. They were all grinding away. So I became the biggest grind they ever had in that place. And I did not drink at all in my first year. And very rarely thereafter until I was finished. With the result that I had done well in school, and I was taken into a large, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, Wall Street law firm. They hired me as sort of the resident immigrant. I'll tell you, though, it wasn't a total loss. I got a little polished up there. I learned to say, oh, really, instead of no shit. Gotcha. My superiors there were very wise men, and they determined that I ought to be trained as a trial lawyer. And so I was sent up to the courthouse in New York City to learn my trade. And I wasn't in the courthouse very long when I discovered that all the smart people were across the street in a saloon. So I moved my office into the saloon. And I learned to drink in a different, more civilized, a more genteel fashion. Very few members of the profession were knocking down shots and beers where anybody could see them. I discovered scotch in a tall glass with water and ice, and you sip on that. It takes a little while, but it gets the job done. I was introduced to all of the mysteries and all of the rituals of the very, very dry martini. And to this day, to this minute, my love, my admiration, and my affection for the very, very dry martini is surely the greatest case of unrequited love the world has ever seen. I was so loyal to those things, and they almost destroyed me. After about a year of this civilizing influence, it was necessary that I be married, necessary in the sense of fulfilling my natural conditions. And I was married right before the war. I'm not talking about World War I or II or III. I'm talking about the war between me and Mrs. O'Keefe. Mrs. O'Keefe is my wife, my current wife. I always call her my current wife. I find it keeps her on her toes. Settled down, and Ms. O'Keefe began to produce children in a rather boring and monotonous fashion, and with the regularity that's known only to the devout Roman Catholic. After about the second of these events, I received a phone call from the law school that I had attended, and I was told to report to the dean, and I went to see the dean, and the dean appointed me to the faculty. And I became Professor O'Keefe. And I responded to that appointment with great alacrity. And there I was, the boy professor. And I was very concerned about that position because it was in a prestigious school. And I didn't really know what there was in my background that justified it. And I was so concerned about it, I knew I drank a great deal. I decided that I would control my drinking. I was then 26 years of age when I thought I'd have to control my drinking. And I entered into a period of controlled drinking, which was very unsuccessful. I just wasn't able to do it, but I tried very hard to do that, and after 2 or 3 years of teaching, as it turned out, I happened to be a good teacher, and I became secure in the teaching, and therefore I didn't see any necessity to control anything. So I went back out to drink the way I wanted to drink, the way I liked to drink. In fact, the only way I knew how to drink. My father died when I was 2, and I had an older brother, Billy, who was 4 years older than I was, and Billy was my hero, and Billy taught me all of the good things, including how to drink. I drank like Billy. I drank until I fell down, or the cops arrived, or a place went on fire, or something would happen. I never realized that you were supposed to stop at some point. And I then went out around and roamed around the city of New York for the next years and drank and did all of those things that you're supposed to do when you roam around the city of New York and drink. And because of my position at the school, I was appointed to a number of commissions and boards and things of that sort in the state of New York. I even ran for office and lost. The only thing I really remember with any satisfaction is I was among a group of people very, very early in the game who surrounded the candidacy of a young senator from Massachusetts that you will remember. And I worked that for him for 3 years. And in this period of time, too, Mrs. O'Keefe and I bought a large, semi-authentic colonial home in a village called Larchmont, New York, a village which abounds in semi-authentic colonial homes. And we had it up to 5 or 6 kids and the usual number of motor vehicles and the usual memberships and the usual obscure clubs. And I was teaching and politicking and working. And had you asked me in those days how I was doing, I would have told you I was doing very well. In fact, I would have told you I was doing very well whether you asked me or not. Was one of my favorite themes. Truth of the matter was, at this time, at age 34, I had turned into a daily drunk. And my day would have killed an ordinary man. I used to come to in the morning in that wet bed because the problem with the kidneys had continued unabated all of those years. And I would struggle out of my damp sack and I would begin my morning calisthenics. My calisthenics were performed kneeling on the floor of a bathroom with my head in a bowl. And I would have all the water running, the water in the shower and the water in the tub and the water in the sink, because I did not want Mrs. O'Keefe and all of those little O'Keefes to know that Professor O'Keefe was dying. I would come downstairs in my sincere blue suit with a vest, carrying over my shoulder, much like Santa Claus, a sack of wet laundry, because Mrs. O'Keefe told me that the diaper service was for the children. You can imagine a man of my stature in a community starting off each morning with a load of wash. But once I got my wash out of the way, help was at hand. I used to keep a quart of vodka in the refrigerator. My children call that daddy's juice. And I'd take a few bangs on daddy's juice. And then the question was, would I throw up in front of all those people? I knew if I lit up a cigarette, I was all over. Sooner or later, I would get into New York City. And on the train, I'd go into Grand Central. And I don't know how familiar you are with Grand Central. You might think it'd be a railroad terminal. It's really a collection of saloons that are connected by tunnels. And I would tear around the tunnels like a mole and pop up here or there. And I'd do a repair job, and then I'd head for that school, and I'd go into that imposing institution, and the first thought I had when I got in there was, how do I get out of here? And I'd get out, and I'd jump in a cab and tear across town and steal $20 from a law firm. Every morning, I'd raid the petty cash, and I'd get 20, and I'd get into another cab, and I'd head down to where I really belonged, the bar down by the courthouse. And by this time, the other lawyers were treating me like a mascot, and I'd throw up 20, and I'd buy one, and they'd buy one, and a bartender would buy one, and maybe we'd eat lunch, and maybe we wouldn't, and maybe we'd talk some business, and maybe we wouldn't, and maybe we'd settle something, and maybe we wouldn't. Really wasn't important, but we'd have a drink every 20 minutes or so. And I had it figured out in some peculiar alcoholic way that I was particularly brilliant at 2 o'clock, and I'd schedule all my classes for 2, and I'd tear up to the school and impose myself on those poor, unwilling, unsuspecting sophisticates who had come to study law at my feet, and I would shortchange them terribly, and then I would tear out of the school and get into a cab and go over to Grand Central to commute. Now, even though I grew up in the city, I understood the theory of commuting. Commuters are entitled to a drink before they get on the train. So I'd have 10 or 12. And I would take a train going north. It didn't have to go to Larchmont. North was good enough for me. And I got to see a great deal more of Bridgeport, Connecticut than any civilized man ought to. Sooner or later, I'd arrive home and I'd bounce off a few walls and take what was left of Daddy's juice out of the refrigerator and fill up an old jelly glass that some kid had left laying around and inquire if anybody wanted a martini. But I was the only one that drank in that house, and I'd have a few pops, and then I would eat or not eat, depending on my mood. Evenings I would spend in civic endeavor. Lawyers are very large for civic endeavor. Civic endeavor by me was cracking up the car or puking on some hostess's sofa or playing a little grab-ass with the ladies of Larchmont. And a sorrier-looking crop you have never seen. Most nights I would just stay home and vegetate, and I would watch television with one eye like that, trying to get those sets to come together, I guess. And I would go through the news and all of the programming and through the late show and on into the morning, and then my big moment would come. When they played the Star Spangled Banner. And the Marines would go up Mount Suribachi. And the planes would fly by. And those destroyers would cut through the water. And they'd be playing that song. And I would cry. Oh! I would weep and sob and cry. And then I'd go upstairs and wet the bed. And that was it. Now, this is not once in a while. This is every day. Weekends, I would save for binges. And if everybody around me would mind their own business, which was extremely rare, I could get drunk 3 times on Saturday and 3 times on Sunday. Well, as anybody who's ever been married can tell you, while all of this was going on, Mrs. O'Keefe was not entirely silent. From time to time, she would have the temerity to suggest that there was something radically wrong with the way I drank. But I pay no attention to her. Why should I? First of all, she's my wife, so she don't know anything. Secondly, she's not an attorney, and I would tell her that. And then we would have the discussion. And I would explain to her the O'Keefe theory of the relativity of alcoholism. To wit, Some people drink more than other people. It's all relative. And I would pursue that theory of mine, which I had finally structured. The logic was impeccable. And I would end it up by saying, as a matter of fact, I don't even drink as much as my mother. And she would say, nobody drinks as much. And now she had offended my mother, and I had to leave for 2 or 3 weeks. So it was wonderful. So she betook herself to her physician, who, as you might imagine, is an obstetrician. And he could find nothing the matter with her until she told him that she lived with a drunk. And this explained a great many things to that great healer, and he sent her home to me with a message. And the message he sent her home with was that I was an alcoholic, and I was very upset when I really got that message, and I rose, as was my custom, to defend myself, and I began my standard jury address, and I went into action, and the first point I made in my summation was a good point. I took a very dim view of a physician who would diagnose someone without having seen him. I was against that shabby type of medical practice. And then I went into high gear, and I asked Mrs. O'Keefe a question to which she has not yet discovered the answer. I asked her what kind of a man became an obstetrician in the first place. Huh? And at this point, the conversation was coming downhill at a very terrible rate. And then it happened. Now, I don't know how this happened. I cannot explain how this happened. I have no explanation for it. I can explain many, many other things to you, and I probably will in the second or third hour of this terrific talk I'm giving here. But in the middle of all of this yelling and screaming, I finally stopped, and I admitted to Mrs. O'Keefe for the first time I'd ever admitted to anyone that there was at least the possibility that I drank too much sometimes. This was a very serious tactical error. Because 3 days later, I found myself a prisoner in a mental institution in Sanford, Connecticut. And I had only been there a matter of moments when I discovered a very serious architectural deficiency in the building. There was no doorknob on my side of the door. They had sandbagged the old professor. And I was overcome with great waves of anger and humiliation and self-pity, because in addition to these outrageous circumstances in which I found myself, it happened also to be the occasion of my 35th birthday. And I mentioned this to a man in a white coat who was passing by. And I very carefully explained to that cretin that on that very day, I had attained age 35. And therefore, under the Constitution of the United States of America, was eligible for the office of president. He urged me not to plan any campaigns. He said there were two other presidents in residence. And he didn't think they could handle a security. Hands upon me, he then left me, and I was all alone for the next several days, and I did all of those warm, wonderful happy, pleasant, and interesting things that alcoholics do when they withdraw from alcohol. I shook. I sweat. I did everything else terrific that you can think about. And I finally came up for air. And I was visited by the staff of the hospital, and they, of course, were psychiatrists. This was a very fancy rattle box, as befitted a man of my stature. And I gave three different doctors three different stories, and they threatened to throw me out of the hospital for lack of cooperation. And I told them what they could do with their hospital, and I returned to where I was staying in this place in Lockwood. I was engaged in a very excellent form of therapy for the alcoholic. I was playing Monopoly. I was playing Monopoly with three guys who were there. They were not alcoholics. They were just there. And one of them was under the impression that I was his real estate broker. And if you know anything about the game of Monopoly, and some nut thinks you're his real estate broker, you can do very, very well. I had the boardwalk, I had a few hotels, and I was in 3 days into the Monopoly marathon, and I was very happy with it. And, sort of a new form of therapy. And in the middle of one of my rolls of the dice, I was told that I had a visitor, and I didn't know who that would be, so I went in my room and I waited. And through the door of that room came this very imposing-looking guy, and he announced that he was from the Darien, Connecticut group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that the hospital had asked him to speak to me of our program. And I immediately reverted to type, and I almost had to bite a neck. I said, Alcoholics Anonymous, what are you, out of your mind? And I started. And he told me to shut up. So tacky. I immediately forgave him. Because I intuitively understood that the hospital had neglected to tell him who I was. So I continued to speak. He told me to sit down and to shut up and to listen to him. Well, he was an imposing-looking guy, and I was not a well person. So for the first time in 35 years, I sat, and he began to explain to me, as I have been trying to indicate to you, and as we are instructed in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, what his life had been like, how he had come to our program, and what life had been for him since. And he asked me if I would like to go with him to meetings. And I said, do you mean outside to meetings, sir? He said, outside. I said, I'll go. Besides that, he gave me matches. Nobody else had allowed me to have any matches. Thought that showed a certain confidence in the old man. And so that's how it began with me. He began driving me around, and we went every night, and this was in January of 1963. And he arranged for me to go locally, and I came out of the place, and I started to attend the meetings locally, and I truly don't recall so much of all of that. I was too new and too nervous and too afraid and too everything. And the hospital had turned me loose with a large jar of those pills that they insisted on giving alcoholics. I was dealing with, as a friend of mine says, I was dealing with that segment of the medical profession that considers the disease of alcoholism to be caused by some type of a Valium deficiency. I was walking around, my head buzzed a lot. But I know myself fairly well. I figured I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You would recognize me as a superior person. You would elect me your president. I was always president. When I joined something, I would serve a term as your president. At the end of the term, you would give me a plaque, and that would be that. Well, should come as no surprise to you, although it was a terrible shock to me, to find out some 10 months later, I was very, very drunk. And, of course, this time, I was drunk with a great difference, because I had turned away from the great power that is in our program. And I was to stay drunk for a period of time. And I won't take you through it. It takes too long, and it still gives me the willies when I think about it. Right now, the hair in the back of my neck goes up. Just let me indicate to you, it was, without question, the worst period of my life. It was murder. It was pure and simple murder. I never knew when I would be drinking. I never knew when I would not be drinking. I never knew where I would be once I began drinking. Things I would drink a week, and then I wouldn't drink a month. I'd drink a month, and I wouldn't drink a week. I would go to these meetings and drink, or I would drink and then go to the meetings. I never knew what was going on. Each day was very much like every other day. And I really didn't know just what I was supposed to do. Things began to happen to me in this period of time that had never happened to me before. And I do not speak to you now of things that happened to me in this period of time that I no longer consider to be significant. I do not speak to you of the fact that I was dismissed from the faculty and fired as a tenured professor of law, and that all of the things that went with that position and all of the honors and all of the titles and all of the prestige and all of the income was taken from me in a period of about 15 minutes. I do not speak to you of the fact that I was in serious, and I mean very serious, personal, professional, and financial difficulties. I do not even speak to you of the fact that I had lost the affection of all those who were around me. What I now speak to you about, which I now understand was happening to me and was present in my case and perhaps in yours, is that there was a terrible, terrible wasting of my spirit. My spirit, that thing that separates me from my cat and separates me even from each of you. And this was a spirit which once burned in me so bright, and it was extinguished, and I knew it, and there was nothing that I could do about it. I'd been here, and this didn't work for me. And by this time, I'd been everywhere else. I'd been through the hospitals and the drying out places and the sanitariums. I've been through the doctors and the nurses and the clergy, and I've been through the jobs and my friends and the politicians, and I've been up and down every avenue that I could think of, and the answer was always the same: I was drunk. And it wasn't as though I didn't know about drinking. I knew about drinking. I had a memory. I remembered the neighborhood. I knew about my family. I'd been to the funerals. I knew what happened to me. I knew what was going to happen to me. And if I gave this any thought at all, I probably thought, well, if this is the way it is with me, then this is the way it is. And I truly, truly did not think it would end as it did. But my time came one day. One day, my time came. I don't know any more about this than you do. But it seems to me that there is a time for all of us. And I say to you that there is a time for each of us. I say to you that there is a line somewhere beyond which we simply are not permitted to go. And I say to you that there is a point somewhere below which we simply are not permitted to sink. And I say to you that there is a level of pain somewhere beyond which no human is required to endure. Now, I don't know where this line is for you. I only know what happened to me. And this is an individual and a personal thing. And it is different in each case. And for some, it may be death. And that's the way it was for my brother Billy. I received a phone call from the Veterans Hospital in Minneapolis, and the man told me that my brother had died in that hospital where he had been taken from the Skid Row of Minneapolis. And so, my brother and my hero died as alcoholics do, without friends, without family, and a long way from our neighborhood. But my brother Billy doesn't drink anymore. And that's how he stopped. And for other people, it can be something trivial. But that line is there somewhere. And we all come to it in our own time and in our own way. But come to it, we must. And I arrived at a day that wasn't so different than any other day. I was in this place where I worked, and I was nervous and afraid and thirsty. I was about 3 days from a drink. And I knew if I had a drink, I'd feel better, but instead of that, I was given the great opportunity of calling a good friend of mine, a longtime member of Alcoholics Anonymous, who was my sponsor. His name is John. And I told him what was happening, and he said he'd be right over, and John came over, and he walked into that room, and he looked so good, and I felt so bad. And I asked him what I would have to do to be as successful as he was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And John gave me that very special look that he has, and he said, "Don't drink. Go to the meetings. You'll be all right." Well, I didn't want him to tell me that. That was much too simple for somebody like me. And I told him I didn't like what he told me. And I was explaining things to him. And I said, "You see, you really don't understand the problem, John. The problem is this place where I work. That's the problem. A lawyer of my talent should not be in a place like this." He said, "Yeah, well, don't drink and you go to meetings. You'll be fine." I said, "Now, John, at home it's worse. You know, I can't even go up there because she's got the court order and all of that." "Yeah," he said, "well, don't drink. You go to meetings. Be right quick." I said, "And I'm getting sued by Bankers Trust. You know about the money, John, that they..." "Yeah," he said, "well, don't drink. You go to meetings." I sensed that there was no dialogue there. And so did John, because he put me on a train and sent me home. And I got off the train at Larchmont, and standing on the platform of the Larchmont station was my mailman, a guy named Al, who was the then chairman of the world-famous Mamaroneck Group. And Al said, "Get in the car." And I said, get out of here, Al. I don't hang around with mailmen. Al said, some guy from New York called me about you. Get in a car. Well, a man of my stature cannot afford to have a fist fight with a mailman or anybody else. So I got in Al's car. I said, Al, I'm in a lot of trouble, Al. And he said, yeah, well, don't drink. You go to me. If any of you are foolish enough to seek my advice because I've come a long distance and I'm an expert from out of town, that's my advice. Don't drink. Go to meetings. You'll be all right. That goes for you too, Ruby. And Al took me up to the world's greatest AA group that night, and I didn't drink that day. And I haven't had a drink since. It seems a long time sometimes. It's really not. But first I had that day. And I had that day because two members of our program were so filled with the gratitude of our program that they took what God sent that day. A drunken, dishonest, arrogant man. And because they were so very grateful for what they had received, they gave me a day. And of course, because I had that day as a gift from them, all of the other days followed. And I began to attend meetings every night, and I still attend meetings every night. And I'd see John every day, and I'd see Al every night, and I would get my instructions. After a few months or whatever it was, John said to me one time, you know, Raymond, he said, you're not such a bad fellow. You hang around pretty good. He said, you don't know anything about the program. Said, it's time to learn. Time to read the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And because I am the way I am, I said, are you kidding me? I read the book. Rarely have we ever seen anyone who ever failed, who has thoroughly followed us. And he gave me that horrible look that he's got. You know that look? That look that long-time members of AA reserve for smart-ass people. And he said, read it again. And I said, yes, John, because by this time, no matter what he said, my answer ultimately was always yes, John. And I began to read again the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was appalled at my initial ignorance. I had no idea that the book had been written 5 years after the meeting of Bill and Bob. No idea that 100 or so men and women had become sober before the book was written. No idea that the steps that are contained in the fifth chapter of that book are steps literally taken by these men and women as they became sober. I thought when first I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, if I told you my name was Ray O'Keefe and I was an alcoholic, I was doing something about the first step of this program. Of course, that's my name and I'm an alcoholic. But the men and women who founded this program did a great deal more than simply identify themselves as alcoholics. They admitted that they were powerless over alcohol, that their lives had become unmanageable. Their lives had become unmanageable because they were powerless over alcohol. They were powerless. They had no power. They were without power. It says in this book that the dilemma of the alcoholic is his lack of power. He has no power. He is powerless. But they didn't drink, and time began to pass for them. And time has passed for me. And time has passed for the great convention in Honolulu. And if you come new, time will pass for you. And time has a wonderful way of passing in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It passes one day at a time. And somewhere after this succession of days, these men and these women came to believe that there was a power greater than their own. And they believed that this power could restore them to sanity. And this was not just a casual observation that they made or an offhand reference that they shared. They believed this. This was part of them. They believed that there was a power greater than their own. And as they believe, I believe. And so firm and so true was that belief that they were able to make a decision to turn over their will and their lives to the care of this power that they had come to believe in, this God, as they each understood him. And they were very, very bright. Because at a time in the history of this country, when no one else had this notion, they considered alcoholism to be a disease. They considered it to be a disease that was physical and mental and spiritual, a disease of the body and the mind and the spirit. And when they stopped drinking, they found that their bodies responded quickly. When they came to believe, they began to enjoy a mental recovery. It was slower than the physical recovery, but it was perceptible. They could notice it. And when they made that decision, that was the key that opened the door. The decision to turn over to life wasn't much. They had admitted that their lives were unmanageable. But the decision to turn over the will to the care of the God of their understanding, that was the thing. The alcoholic will, that was the thing that got me into all of that trouble for all of those years. I never knew it. I was what the book describes an extreme example of self-will run riot. But when they made that decision, when they offered themselves to God to do with as he would, when they asked to be relieved of the bondage of self so that they might better do his will, when they asked that their difficulties be taken from them so that it would give evidence to those that they would help his love and his power and his way of life, and they asked that they do his will always, they began then a spiritual way of life to which you and I are heir. They left that to us. And they were smart enough to know, too, that it wasn't enough to simply stop drinking and start praying. A lot of people have tried it. It doesn't work. They knew that if they were to be successful somehow, they would have to change. And in order to effect this change in themselves, they began a searching and a fearless moral inventory of themselves. They could be searching because now they were relatively clear. They could be fearless because they had made a decision to turn their lives over to the care of a God of their understanding. Imagine an alcoholic without fear. That is impossible. It embarrasses me to tell you that the ruling emotion of my life when I drank was fear. For all of those years, the great man and the boy professor was afraid most of the time. But this step helps with that. And when they were finished with this inventory, so great was the love and the affection of these people one for the other, that they could readmit their inventory to themselves, to the God of their understanding, and they took it to someone else and they shared it with them. It's a great relief for me to be able to bring this to my sponsor and to give it to him so that he was able to tell me the exact nature of my wrongs. And then they developed an attitude which was difficult for me. They became entirely ready to have God remove all their defects of character. And with compelling logic, they went to this great power that they had come to believe in. And they humbly asked him to take their shortcomings from them. And it began to work for them. And no one who ever considers or thinks or writes about our program can ever dispute the fact that it works. And if there was ever any doubt that it does, one need only be present in the great city of Honolulu, in your convention here assembled, to know that it works. It truly works. And they knew they had not come here alone. They knew that in their lives, as in mine, there was a certain amount of wreckage, and so they wrote a list of everyone they had ever harmed, and they became willing to make amends to everyone on the list. And they didn't just talk about it. They went out and they did it. And you may remember in Dr. Bob's story, it tells us in his first day, he got back home a little late, and Bill asked him where he had been, and he said he was out mending fences. It's an old Vermont expression. He was making amends the very first day that he stopped drinking, and I don't think we need wait so long in order to do everything that is expected of us. And by this time, these were very sober people, and great joy and benefits came into their lives. And these are the things that they want us to have. And in order to show us what happened to them when they were finished with their work in the ninth step, they write for us in this book. Let's see if I can read this. Bad eyes. It says in this book that if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past or wish to shut the door upon it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scales we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us all of the things that we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly. They will always materialize if we work for them. And I'm very happy to report to you that each and every one of those promises has come into my life as solely as a result of being a member of this great fellowship. And by this time, they knew and understood that they had been giving something very precious. And so they resolved that they would maintain it. And in order to maintain it, they continued to take personal inventory. They knew they could not enjoy the luxury of a resentment. They knew if they were resentful or hateful, they would drink. And if they drank, they would die. It was simple with them. And so when they were wrong, they promptly admitted that they were wrong. And so great and so true was their reliance upon this power that they had come to believe in, this God as they each understood him, that they resolved to improve their conscious contact with God. And they did that by prayer and by meditation. They meditated. They gave thought to their condition. They considered who they were and what they were. And they engaged in a very excellent form of meditation. It is the form of meditation in which you are now engaged. They listened. They listened on the odd chance that this power that they had come to believe in would speak to them. And this power that they had come to believe in did speak to them in their groups at their meetings. And they prayed, brothers, they prayed. And no one needs a sermon from me on the value of prayer. When they prayed only for knowledge of God's will for them and the power to carry it out. I don't know however it was with you, but it always seemed to me when I was young and coming along that I really did not belong where I was. I had this feeling that I was in the wrong home, in the wrong family, in the wrong school, in the wrong neighborhood, and everything was wrong. And this feeling persisted as I went through life. And even though the outside was fitting in perfectly as it went along, or at least it fit in well as it went along, I was a successful kid, I had friends, I was good at school, all the rest of it. I always had that feeling. I always had that hole where the wind blows and it makes the days very long and the nights very dark because I didn't belong. And then I came here and I learned of these steps and our program and I began a practice of prayer. And in the 12 and 12, at the last paragraphs on the 11th step, it tells us, and this is not a quote that in words or substance, that one of the greatest benefits of prayer is the great sense of belonging that comes to us. We are no longer lost or alone or frightened or purposeless. That we understand that the values of life are truth and justice and love. And that we understand that a loving God watches over us. And that when we turn to Him, all will be well with us here and hereafter. And I can report to you that sense of belonging has come to me. And so when I say to you that I am Ray O'Keefe, an alcoholic and a member of that group, I am telling you who I am and what I am and where I belong. And it isn't enough for me to be a member of that group. I belong to that group. And it isn't simply that I am here with you this evening. I belong here with you this evening. There is nowhere else that I belong except here. And a little while later, these men and these women came upon another prayer, and they thought that it would help them, and so they appropriated it. And they prayed for themselves, and the only thing they asked was peace of mind. And so they prayed that God would grant them the serenity to accept the things they could not change. And they did change. And something happened to them. Something happened to these men and women. Something has happened to me, and if you come, something will happen to you. There was a great difference in these men and women, a great difference between being drunk and being sober, a great conversion of their attitudes, a great substitution of their standards. And this change, this difference between being drunk and being sober, they termed a spiritual awakening. And they had this spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And these were the men and the women who at the beginning of this process had admitted that they were hopeless and helpless and powerless. These were the ones who had no power. But having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, they found that they held in their hands and in their hearts and in our program one of the greatest sources of spiritual power that the world has ever seen. They actually had the power to arrest the disease of alcoholism. They actually actually had the power to save life. And the only thing they were using was the great power of example of one drunk for another. And armed with that power, and having had that kind of a spiritual awakening, they began to carry the message to the alcoholic. And they did that so well that you and I have come together on a night in November of 1982 in the magical city of Honolulu in the great state of Hawaii. And that, my dear brothers and sisters, is a long, long way from Akron, Ohio. And they knew what my friends Tom and Colleen know. They know what my friend Jean knows. They knew what Herb knows. That there is so much more to our program besides a device to keep me from drinking like a pig. They knew that what had been handed to them was an entirely new way of living. And in order to enjoy that new way of living, they resolved that they would practice principles in all their affairs. And so where they had been, as I always was, very dishonest, they tried not to be so dishonest. Where they had been, as I always was, very arrogant, they tried not to be so arrogant. Happily for me, they said we were not saints. They said it is not a program of spiritual perfection. It is a program of spiritual progress. And my sponsor has instructed me, and so I believe that I can progress in this program if I don't drink and go to the meetings. I could keep you for many, many more minutes and tell you of all of the wonderful things that have happened to me since I have become sober. But I have my instructions and I will not keep you. If you have a good wish for me, and I know that you do, please be assured that anything you might wish for me has already happened in my life, wholly, solely, and simply because I am a member of this fellowship. Everything, every position, every honor, every title that alcoholism took from me, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, has returned to me. And I won't burden you with the accomplishments which I've been able to do only because I'm a member of this fellowship. I'll just tell you two things. One, because it is so recent and so new that it's almost frightening. And I speak to you and I tell you in the confidence of this room that a week ago Tuesday I was nominated to be dean of our law school. If my colleagues elect me, and I have no idea what they will do, just is something, as it says in this book, when we do what we are supposed to do, things work out better than we could have planned. That is item number one. Item number two is something which is, I think, even more significant because it truly, truly means more to me. And that is that I bring you the warm, the fraternal, and the loving greetings of five of my children, who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Why I should be applauded for my children, I don't know. But I tell you that that is something. I don't know if it's a record, but I'm getting a lot of distance, I'll tell you. And I got a couple of more I'm looking at. In any event, I would be remiss, and if Estelle, I might go over a couple of minutes, I would be remiss if I did not thank Estelle and all of the committee, or whoever it was who exercised a very good judgment to bring me in. I don't know why Estelle was surprised when I said, sure. Anybody calls me and says, I'm calling from Honolulu. I don't want to know the rest, but I say, sure, that's right. I'm on the way. It truly is an experience which comes because we are so much together and so sober. And I will report back to the world famous, as I am required to do by Article 78 of our bylaws. And I will tell them that for the period of time I have been with you, you have shown me your warmth and your love and your affection, and that you have made me truly feel at home. And if I give a good report of you to that group, and if they approve of you, then you have nothing else to fear. I am one of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous who travel about a great deal and bring my story along with me, and my story is always the same, and if you've heard it before, you're hearing it again, and I make no apology for that. I say the same thing just about all the time. And when I end, I say what I'm about to say. I refer you to one of our pamphlets. It is called A Member's View of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is a pamphlet which is dear to me. And at the end of that pamphlet, the author takes a biblical turn. And he reminds us of the time when John the Baptist was once again languishing in one of Herod's prisons. And John sent two of his friends to inquire of his cousin Jesus as to whether or not he was the Messiah. And so these two men found the Lord, and they walked with him a while. And they stopped him, and they said to him, are you the Messiah? Are you the one that we have been waiting for, or should we wait for another? And the Lord really didn't answer that question, but he said to these two men, go back to John and tell John only what you have heard and only what you have seen. Tell John that the blind see and the lame walk. Tell John that the deaf hear and the sick are made well. And tell John that the poor have the gospel brought to them. In my early training, I was told that the word poor in that context could mean poor in spirit. And everyone knows that the word gospel simply means good news. And so, my dear, dear brothers and sisters, here in happy convention assembled, if you will accept a report from me based upon 17 years of sobriety in our program, I will tell you only what I have seen and only what I have heard. And based upon that observation, it seems to me that the blind do see, and the lame do walk. And I know that the deaf can hear. And most certainly, the sick become well. And I have seen over and over and over again through the longest day and into the darkest night the good news of our program brought to the alcoholic who still suffers, the poor in spirit. Aloha and mala.